Hi everyone, I'm Anita Lustria, and in my world, conversation is king. A number of years ago, when I lost my big job of being a radio talk show host, I decided I could mope around and be sad. Okay, I did a bunch of that. Or I could move on and start a podcast so I could keep the conversation going. That's how this podcast was born. As you listen, you'll hear about things that are important to me, and hopefully you'll resonate with these topics as well. Welcome to Faith Conversations. Today, I am very pleased to have Karen Gonzalez on the podcast. She's a writer, a speaker, an immigrant advocate who works as director of human resources for World Relief. Tremendous organization. We'll hear a little bit more about them as the podcast goes along. I think maybe one of the most important parts about Karen as we get into our conversation today, she is an immigrant from Guatemala. And she's studied at Fuller Theological Seminary, and she's been and worked in the nonprofit world for more than 10 years. And also, she's a former public school teacher. So woohoo for our teachers in the midst. A lot of educators in our extended, my extended family and Mike's extended family. So that's a, we love hearing that as well. She has authored the book, The God Who Sees: Immigrants, the Bible, and the Journey to Belong. So Karen, welcome to Faith Conversations.
Thank you, Anita. It's good to be here.
Well, I'm excited to have this conversation. I think it's a very important one. I think it's an important one all the time, but I'm sure, I know you have heard people say, I think it's especially important right now. Obviously, it's a hot button in our country right now, and for a lot of different reasons, and we'll, yeah, and a lot of things are going on that you've got people probably all over the map in what they think about that, but some of, I'll just say for me, a lot of what's going on is kind of heartbreaking right now, and I want to get into some of your story, because I know you tell some of your story, you kind of interweave your story through the book, along with talking about some sacraments, which I think is a fascinating way to go about telling your story and also talking about immigration. But I want to first stop at this particular spot in the conversation. You've said, I want somebody to write about this topic who is an immigrant. I read that you talked about that and said, you know, I love that there are books out there on the topic, but where are the immigrants writing this? And then what did someone say to you?
They said, why don't you write that book, Karen?
Ding, 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 ding. Yeah, yeah. Had it not occurred to you that maybe you could be the one to, or be one of the ones to write a book? Or, yeah.
It hadn't. I just thought there was this, in my mind, there was this dichotomy between activists and writers. And I didn't really think I could put the two together. And yeah, it suddenly dawned on me, no, I could write this. I have the space, the calling, the skill to be able to do it. And so, yes, that's the first time I began to really pray about, could this be something that God is asking me to do?
And the other piece that I love about what you include in the book, you talk a lot about what the Bible has to say about immigration. I think sometimes we forget there are a boatload of immigrants in Scripture and stories that specifically speak to some of what is going on today in our world. And but I want to go back. I want you to kind of go back in your own story to the beginning, because you were not born here in the United States. So tell us some of your journey to come here to the United States.
Sure. So I was born in Guatemala. I lived there till I was 9 years old, and I would say I had the kind of family that did not ever think they would migrate. We had relatives in the U.S. My parents had some friends in Canada even. And we'd had some family members that had actually chosen to migrate to Mexico as the war was escalating in Guatemala. And my parents, that was not their dream or their goal in any way. My dad worked for an American humanitarian organization in Guatemala. And I heard someone say this, that what really drove my family to migrate was not a longing for the American dream, but rather an escaping a Central American nightmare. This like war really, not only did so many people lose their lives, and there were so many, there's so much terror because of disappearances, because of threats, and but there was also a destabilizing of the Guatemalan economy, and neighboring El Salvador as well suffered some of the same fate that we did. And it was just a really difficult time. And it's when many Guatemalans fled. I read in a book once that outside of Guatemala City, one of the largest cities of Guatemalans in the world was Los Angeles, because that's where many people fled.
Oh, isn't that interesting? That's fascinating. Yeah. I get that. Actually, this just popped into my head. But I spent, when I was 15, I spent that summer 10 weeks in Guatemala. But up in the mountain region, like San Miguel Acatan, you know, and I, so it's just interesting that that popped back into my head. I'm surprised I didn't think about it sooner with your heritage and background. So, but were you in Guatemala City? Is that where you were living?
Yes, you I was in Guatemala City. Yeah. So my mom was from the Caribbean coast, and my dad was from a city, and my mom had, they met because she moved to the city to go to nursing school. And so the city is where I grew up and lived, and we did quite a bit of traveling around the country as well, but that's primarily where I was living. And so when my family migrated, we moved to the U.S. We had, I have an uncle who had married a U.S. citizen, and he had just become a naturalized citizen. And so we thought it seemed natural to move to the U.S., and so we did. But unfortunately, when you have a relative who can sponsor you, you still have to wait in line for a visa to become available. There are only so many visas issued each year, immigrant visas. And so it took my parents about 2.5 years to wait for that visa. And so from, you know, 1981 to 1984, they were undocumented. And that's one of the reasons we moved to Los Angeles, because it was an easier city to be lost in.
Ah, that makes perfect sense. Do you find, and even as you're throwing around the terms, you know, only a certain number of visas issued each year, and a sponsor, so you're using some of these terms that someone who is engaged in the immigration process, they know these terms very well.
Right.
Do you find that the majority of Americans who might be extremely opinionated about the immigration process, I'm not even talking about which side they're on, are generally not knowledgeable, but have opinions?
Yes. And it's easy to do, because I think people usually have a little bit of information and they think they understand the whole process. But even immigration attorneys, even accredited representatives who work in the field, are constantly learning, a kind of continuing education, because laws change and evolve. We know President Trump has a lot of strong beliefs around immigration, and he's instituted executive actions that have changed things in a number of ways. You know, one of the biggest questions I get when I go to a church to speak about immigration is, I'm not against immigration. I just want people to get in line. And I understand that sentiment and that question, but for many people, there is no line. There's no line to get into. The fact that I had a relative who could sponsor us is just an extreme blessing, that we didn't even know how huge it was, because so many people have no relational connections or people who can sponsor them.
And, so and I'm realizing people listening to the podcast, they may not even know what sponsoring means, or that a sponsor is needed or helpful. What and you might talk about what it looks like with and without a sponsor.
Sure. So a sponsor means that you have a close relative. So it has to be a very close relative, a parent, a sibling. you know, you have a child who is over 21 and earns income. Mm-hmm. Those are the people that can sponsor, and that's it. So this idea that any relative, you know, that, you know, can sponsor is just not true at all. And that's a misconception that lives in the world. It has to be a close relative, and then they have to prove to the government that you're not going to be a burden, meaning you're not going to go on public benefits. So they have to submit that they're going to be responsible for you for the next 10 years.
Oh, right. 10 years.
Yeah. So it's quite a thing to sponsor someone. So my you can sponsor your sibling. So my uncle sponsored my father, okay, who then extended that sponsorship to us. But if my dad, let's say, had died, mm-hmm, my uncle could not have sponsored my mom because they're not related.
Blood related. Okay. Mm-hmm. Wow. All right.
So that's the way that works. You know, our wait was somewhere almost 3 years. The current wait for a sibling sponsoring another sibling is 13 years. And if you're from China, India, the Philippines, or Mexico, it's 23 years to wait for that visa. So the
wait, what?
Yeah, the lines have become extremely long.
Okay, let's talk about why the lines are extremely long. Every answer you give raises more questions, right?
Yeah.
But I think it's really important to understand the process and to also, and you know what? We are going to get into the content of your book eventually. But, mm-hmm, but I think this is some of why you also decided as an immigrant to write, because there are,
yes,
these questions. There is so much misunderstanding or just lack misinformation or and just plain lack of information besides the misinformation, mm-hmm, that's out there. So, all right, let me move back and go, okay, what was the highest amount? You said like up to 23 years. Okay,
mm-hmm,
unbelievable. And so if you have a sponsor, so you were able to be in the country and undocumented as you waited? Is that...
Well, technically, of course, your ideal situation would be to wait in your country for the immigrant visa to become available.
Gotcha.
And there are some people around the world who are able to do that. You know, you sponsor someone who's living in a relatively peaceful country that's stable, then it's not a problem to wait.
Right.
But for many people, for example, we could not have waited in Guatemala. The situation was dire and we had to leave. And so my parents had a tourist visa, so they flew in and overstayed the visa.
Okay.
And about 50% of the undocumented immigrants in the U.S. Overstay a visa. That's why many immigration advocates are against the building of the wall, because it wouldn't stop the 50% that are coming in that way.
I have so many questions. So there are people here, and then there are people who are coming to seek asylum.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and I am assuming asylum seekers, you seek asylum when your situation is unsafe where you've come from.
Correct.
But then there are only a certain number of immigrants that are received into the country. So here's my, I guess I need to get, I'm trying to get the terms right, okay?
Sure.
So when you hear that number of whatever it is, 33,000 and something, or what, I don't have the number right, but you know what I'm talking about, don't you,
mm-hmm,
with that number?
Mm-hmm.
The number of immigrants that are allowed to be resettled here or settled in the United States, are those the visas that have been extended and offered? Is that the number of visas?
So asylees, well,
are there
it's
two?
Different.
We're talking two different things, aren't
yeah,
we? That's what I want.
Things.
That's
yeah,
what I think people don't understand. And as you can right, tell, I don't understand it. And so, yeah, let's help us understand.
Sure. So refugees, so for example, in 2016, we welcomed 85,000 refugees to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Each of those people who arrives here in the U.S. comes with permission to stay and an immigrant visa, essentially. And so then they just apply for their green card within a year. And
do all of those, that number have a sponsor? Is that how they have arrived?
So they don't have a sponsor because they're refugees.
Yeah, thank you.
This is just something, a program that the United States participates in with the UN. And so the United States issues these visas without those relational connections.
Now, there may indeed be sponsoring cities or churches or organizations. Yes. That's what I hear about, that welcome immigrant families to their area. And then people step forward and say, hey, I want to be a welcoming presence, a liaison, a sponsor, if you will, after the fact. I'm sure all kinds of language is used where we're going to help you find a place to live and we're going to help you find furniture and we're going to just check on you regularly because we want your assimilation into a new place to be warm and friendly and filled with care. And that's what...
That's correct.
Okay.
So when refugees arrive, there's 9 agencies, World Relief being one of them, that help them to resettle here in the U.S. And so before they arrive, World Relief sets up an apartment and furniture, all with like donations and the many, many volunteers who form what we call good neighbor teams. And so they walk alongside a refugee family or individual for about 6 months, just helping them to integrate into the culture and understand how things work here in the U.S. I mean, even something as simple as like, what's a parent-teacher conference and what are you supposed to do in the U.S.? and what am I supposed to do about this, you know, or this field trip slip? What is this? What do
or
I do with
how
it?
How do I find a dentist?
Exactly.
Or, right?
Apply for a social security card and all those things that we know because we live in this country and we know how to navigate it. But for someone coming in new, they need someone to walk alongside them. And so that's the refugee program. Asylees, essentially, what they do is they arrive at a U.S. port of entry and they ask for refugee status, essentially. So that's what asylum is asking to be a refugee, but rather than waiting in a camp in a third country that you fled to, you instead show up at the country at the port of entry and you ask for this. And so there has to be a process for it. So the people that are arriving at the border, you know, there's this humanitarian crisis at our southern border. They are wanting to seek asylum. So they're not wanting to enter undocumented. They're asking to enter into this legal process, which is a part of our law, and it's their right to ask for. And so this is why many advocates are upset about what's happening at the border, because people are being denied their right to ask for it. And asylum is a very difficult immigration solution to get. It's probably the most difficult, in my opinion. But it's still their right to ask for it because it's very difficult to prove that you have a credible fear, which is what you have to prove, and that you're being persecuted under specific categories. Mm. So I've heard, for example, many people say, oh, Ruth and Naomi were refugees. They weren't. Ruth and Naomi were economic immigrants because they fled due to a famine, not due to political oppression, not due to any of the only 5 categories qualify for that, for asylee or refugee status. And so, see, these are some of the complications that make it very difficult for the average person to understand. And yet a lot of people assert very powerful opinions over these processes. And that's really hard for those of us, you know, who field these questions to hear people say things. Back during, you know, the early part of the 20th century, the late 19th century, 98% of the immigrants who came to Ellis Island were offered an immigrant visa. 98%. Basically, you couldn't be coughing or have a clear, you know, disease and you were welcomed into the country. And now, I mean, it's a fraction of that, a tiny, tiny fraction. You have to have a relational connection. Your relational connection has to earn enough income. They have to be able to prove they can take care of you. They have to have a clean record. They have to have paid their taxes. I mean, it's a rigorous and expensive process.
So that's another important word, expensive process. As you were talking about early, what century, early in the 19th, did you say? Or 20,
yeah.
Yeah.
19th and early 20th century.
And early 20th. Yeah. So my son is a Civil War scholar. He just returned from an annual conference. He attends the Civil War Institute. And he said this, there was a panel discussion. He said this statistic blew him away. He wrote it down and it just surprised him. So American Civil War. So this is going to be early 1861, 60 to 65 in there. All right. Mm-hmm. In the Union Army, 25% of the Union Army were foreign born. 18% were children of immigrants. 10% were African Americans. That's 53% in total. were part of, yes. That were part of that army. More than half that were part of this army that are people who were and are still struggling and marginalized. And I just found that fascinating, but okay to be fighting a war, right? Fighting in a war. I just wanted to raise that because that statistic kind of surprised me, and that was the 1860s. So, yes, not to mention the money. I think this is another piece that many of us don't recognize and realize. Oh, I had to pay this much here at the beginning, and oh, whoops, now I have to pay this much more, and oh, wait, there's more. What is the, really, what are the costs, and how much does each immigrant end up paying to when they go through the process?
Yeah. It's expensive and it depends on what you're asking for.
Oh, interesting.
So for example, so if you're just renewing a work permit, it could be $500. Those young people that are on DACA who were brought here as children, they have to renew every 2 years and it's $575. And they have to prove they haven't committed any crimes. They have to submit a police report and they have to show proof of either employment or that they're enrolled as full-time students. If you want to become a U.S. citizen, it's about $1,000. It just depends on what you're doing. So throughout the course of an immigrant's life here in the U.S., they could spend thousands and thousands of dollars on renewing applications. Basically, until you become a citizen, you have to keep paying these fees to renew whatever permission is that you have here in the U.S. And even I'm a naturalized citizen. I became a citizen when I was 19. And there was a point where I thought I had lost my naturalization certificate, which is what I need to apply for a U.S. passport. You mm-hmm. know? And even just the replacement of that document is $575.
Really?
Yeah. So everything is extremely costly. And don't get me wrong. I understand the DHS and USCIS, they need this money, right, to run. There's already a huge backlog, and so they need this money to run the programs and to be able to process the petitions, but it's not free by any means. It is an extremely expensive process.
Yeah. Hey, friends. I'm interrupting the podcast for just a quick minute. People ask me all the time how to best support the podcast. Well, you can do it in a number of ways. I'd love to have you give via the Patreon app. That's one way. It's the first icon at the bottom of my homepage, anitalustria.com. Or you can give using PayPal. The email address to use is producer@anitalustria.com. And I know some of you prefer mailing a check, and that'll work too. The mailing address is 8 White Oak Terrace, Sarasota, Florida, 34237. Now, if you have a few extra minutes, I'd like to ask you to write a review for Faith Conversations on iTunes. Reviews are super important to any podcaster, and it helps elevate the podcast and make more people aware. Also, if you have an interest, share it on Twitter or Facebook. That also helps. Now, back to the conversation. I think the other thing that's so troubling to me, and you hear this in your work with World Relief, you just alluded to that, you know, in our current political climate, there really, the rhetoric is sometimes frightening. You know, mm-hmm. It has been violent, certainly unwelcoming, and even the policies are not very welcoming currently. It's a system that needs, at best, I mean, it's a system that does need some overhauling and changing. And, you know, I think probably everyone will ascribe to that, at least I assume. But just nothing is happening with that. And so things continued. And when I say nothing is happening, what am I really saying? is it stuck between parties? Is it just political wrangling? Is it, you know, we have more voices and votes right now and so it's going nowhere? Say a word about that.
Yeah. So really we thought the best opportunity for some kind of immigration reform act to pass through Congress would have been when President Obama first took office, because he had the presidency and Congress. He had the majority, and President Obama pushed through the Affordable Care Act first. And I think that's good and important too for people to have health care that's affordable. And unfortunately, by the time immigration came around, he had lost the majority in Congress in order for that to happen. You know, they call immigration this sort of wedge issue, that it's a losing issue. So both parties will talk about it, especially around election times. But neither party really has had the will to really bring lasting change. Okay. And you know, often people tell me, oh, you know, I'm a conservative, or, you know, I'm a, you know, Democrat. I'm pro these things. It really doesn't matter. Both parties have failed the immigrant community and our country as a whole. And as a matter of fact, historically, you know, President Reagan did an amnesty for undocumented immigrants. Some of my relatives were able to adjust their status through that. Some of the most harmful policies came through under President Clinton. You know, he established this like bar that bars you 10 years, even if you're married to someone, even if you have a relational connection, if you've acquired any time in the U.S. undocumented from zero to, you know, from at least 6 months to a year, you have to go back to your country for 3 or 10 years, depending. It's really, no party has been pro reform and change. And
I think that's really helpful to hear, because I think it's really easy to point fingers at, you know, we stand there and point fingers at each other, and really all are to blame here.
Yes, all are to blame. I always tell people it's important for you. You know, we live in a constitutional republic, and it's important for your legislators to hear from you, because really it will only be the will of the people that will motivate them to really update this system, because it is an outdated system. You know, what was working for when my family migrated at the time, the Immigration and Nationality Act was 15 years old. Well, now it's a really old program. You know, it's almost 50 years old, and there haven't been significant changes made to it. And the lines have gotten incredibly long, and it's not kept up with both the needs of our neighbors and our own labor needs in our own country.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And yes, what is the movie, you know, whether you like it or not, that it set in Southern California, and I don't even know enough to know if it's it talks about basically a day without an immigrant population, right? Do you know what I'm talking about?
one day without a Mexican.
Oh, is that okay? In some ways, everybody needs to watch that. I mean, you know, I don't think a lot of people think about that. But I want to go back to the money piece as well, though, because when you do look at the immigrant population, now this is a broad brushstroke, but the kinds of jobs that largely are available to them are not the kinds of jobs where they can earn the kind of money to be paying these exorbitant fees that have to be paid on an annual or more frequent basis. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to come back to that as well.
Yeah.
Okay. So... kind of laying the groundwork here, because I think it's important to be talked about. But let's also, we can't move forward before we talk about the crisis at the border, because it indeed is a crisis. Mm-hmm. You're with World Relief, and you have people who are working at the border. There are other good organizations working there. I'm just raising my hand to say, you know, support some of the folks working at the border. Here we are talking with Karen, who works with World Relief, and that is one fine organization that you might consider supporting. What is happening at the border? And talk about that, the current crisis.
Sure. Actually, I was recently at the border, San Diego, Tijuana side in California. And what's happening at the border is a humanitarian crisis. It is not, we're not being invaded by a foreign army. And people are not trying to enter the country illegally. They are, in fact, presenting themselves and asking to apply for asylum. And that's what's happening. And this is being fueled by these crises that are going on in Central America and what they call the Northern Triangle. And that's El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And people are fleeing that situation because there have been these gangs. I mean, there's ongoing problems. And some of it, I mean, this is a reality we have to reckon with as Americans, is that we have created the war that my family fled was funded by the U.S. The gangs that are terrorizing Central America were born in Los Angeles, because the people who fled when my family fled then had children who grew up in these urban neighborhoods and who needed to protect themselves from other gangs. And so they went to prison. They learned how to become hardened criminals. They got deported when they came out as immigrants who commit crimes do. You know, if you commit a serious crime and when you come out of prison, you are deported. So we've created some of these issues that are destabilizing these countries, including many of the issues with their economies. And so, you know, people often ask me, like, why can't these countries rule themselves? You know, why can't, you know, African countries and Central American countries and Latin American? But often we've gone and we plundered their resources and destabilized their economies. And we have to accept that responsibility, that partially we're responsible, our government is, for what's happening in these countries. And we're responsible at another level, too, that often isn't talked about, and that is the rhetoric that we use when we talk about other countries. You know, our president famously said these countries, you know, have nothing. They're these poor places. Even people in those countries internalize these terrible messages. And I think a lot of internal migration doesn't happen because they are hearing that their country's nothing, that it's corrupt, that there's nothing good there, that everything good is in the West. And this is, I've seen that even in Guatemala. I've seen that, you know, in Mexico. And my brother and sister-in-law live in Mexico and work at the U.S. Embassy. And it's just disheartening to see people internalize these messages, because it becomes a kind of self-hatred, right? Like, mm-hmm. I'm not good, and anywhere I come from isn't good. But that's what's fueling the crisis, is all of these factors. And so people are migrating north, and they're coming to the U.S. because there's a labor market here. And that's true. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can say we don't want immigrants, but the fact is most of our food comes from California's Central Valley. 75% of the migrant farm workers are undocumented. I mean, that's just a reality. Our citizens do not want to do this work.
I was going
to
say, deport that population, and what happens? Fruits and vegetables rot in the fields, correct?
Exactly. And they've even done experiments. Like, there was these farms in Washington State when there was a crackdown on immigration who were paying like $15 an hour to U.S. citizens who would come and work the fields. They still did not get workers. And fruit, apples rotted in the trees because there were not enough workers. There's this, you know, immigrants have always built, they come into these jobs and they've always sort of been the backbone of the working class. And then their children go to college and their children become, you know, sort of the next generation. And that's the way it's been historically in the United States. So to all of a sudden say, well, we don't want these people, we don't need them, is to not really look around and see the fact that, in fact, we need each other as human beings. We have a shared humanity. And as we look around our country, we see the different roles that people are playing and that all of them are necessary, even if they don't receive equal respect or dignity.
Okay, there's just so much to think about the issue itself, let alone what you've written in your book. And I definitely we are going to talk about the God who sees, because I think it's really important. But I do want to go one step further with the crisis at the border. Because you've been there, is what we hear, is that really what's happening? People are coming in and they're basically being warehoused in conditions that are just too close, too tight, too whatever. I would love for you to speak to that.
Well, the detention centers are a reality, and that is true, because there are so many people coming and they simply don't have the capacity to hold, you know, as many people as are arriving. They are overcrowded. I have not visited the detention centers myself. Some of my colleagues have. What we visited and wanted to see was the work that the Mexican church is doing to address this migrant crisis. And it was very heartening to see. And I thought, we have so much to learn from one another. I was so heartened to see how Mexican leaders and churches are stepping up. There's shelters for deportees. There's shelters for asylees. And so now what's happening is they're asking Mexico to keep people until their, you know, asylum application is processed.
Well,
I don't know how that's going to work. It could take years to process an application.
That's what I was just going to say. You know, with what you've just shared with us, this is not a short-term venture of housing people. Yeah. Very interesting. Okay. All right. Let's move on from this information that we've been given, and especially, I mean, so helpful from your perspective working with immigrants. And so do say a word about what World Relief does. For someone not familiar with World Relief, yes, I've mentioned that you are working at the border, but what is the broad scope of what World Relief does?
Mm-hmm. So World Relief is a humanitarian organization. It is Christian. It is an arm of the National Association of Evangelicals. So evangelicals do care about immigrants.
I know that to be true. Yes.
And basically, it has two major areas of work. There's the work that we do in the U.S. is all focused on the foreign-born. And so we're one of nine agencies that does refugee resettlement. And we also do immigrant legal services, and we work with survivors of human trafficking who are foreign-born. Okay. And so at the border, we partner with an organization called Al Otro Lado, and they are working to do legal work, because a lot of the support that immigrants need, and this is a question I get asked a lot, is what can I do to help families, to help immigrants at the border, to address this crisis? The best thing that you can do is you can give to these organizations that are, because you need legal professionals doing this work of helping people with their petitions and walking the process with them. You can also give to shelters working over the border in Mexico, because they need the support to be able to serve people as they're waiting, and some as they're making their lives. People who are deported can't come back, and so they have to build new lives now in Mexico or wherever they're going.
And
I'll
ask you this. Can I get some names and websites, and I'll put that in the show notes of the podcast for people?
Absolutely.
I'll get that from you afterwards. And that, yeah. So folks, you can check that out at anitalustria.com and in the show notes of the podcast, wherever you download it from, it'll be there. All right.
It's also in the back of my book.
Oh, excellent. So I don't even need to keep you afterwards. I can just go here and I can print it out, or people can just go buy the book and get it as well, The God Who Sees. And I want to mention it's published by Herald Press. Talk about the format of The God Who Sees, because it's part memoir and part what? Yeah.
So The God Who Sees is part memoir, where I tell the story of my family's immigration, which I remember because I was with them. And I tell the story through sacraments in the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church really shaped my early imagination of faith in a lot of ways, especially back then. To be Latin American was to be Catholic, because either you were culturally Catholic or you were actually Catholic.
Right.
And so, so I tell the story through the sacraments, because it's also the story of how I came to faith through that immigration journey. And really, I was inspired to do that. There's a missiologist out of Asbury College who talks about his research is on immigration and faith, and has found that immigrants are either more likely to be or to become Christians, in
Interesting.
Fact.
Okay.
And so, I mean, you don't find a lot of people who have to make that journey who identify as agnostic or atheist.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a very, so for me, I wanted people to hear that story. I wanted them to hear some different parts. Like, for example, our life in Guatemala was really good. It is quite a beautiful country, and there's lots of good in it. There's innovation, there's imagination, there's professionals. But also there was a war, and that's what pushed my family out. I wanted them to see those push factors, and I wanted them to know what it's like to live undocumented, because that was our early life in the U.S. And our lives changed dramatically. I mean, like night and day, not to use a cliche, but night and day. Yeah. From when we were undocumented, and my parents' chief concern was just flying under the radar.
Sure.
To becoming documented, and all of a sudden you could think about things like, oh, I want to buy a house. I want to find a little league team for my son. I want to, you know, because now there's freedom even to move and live where you want and not feel like I'm tied to living in certain communities where I can hide. Mm. So I wanted people to see that as well, and to see some of the struggles of immigrant families, even in just the process of acculturation and integration. And, you know, to a certain extent, my parents lost us to another culture because we grew up here. And so we're Americans, whereas they remain firmly Guatemalan, having moved here in their 30s as adults.
Sure. Yeah, a lot different than moving at 9 years old like you did, right?
Right.
Yeah. And what does that feel like for your parents? You know, I've got to believe there's a sadness in it. I mean, you didn't want to pick up and leave.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And yet I would think too, for how many siblings do you have?
Two.
It's just, okay. So you and your siblings, there's also a joy in it because you are in lives that are flourishing today and they look mm-hmm. very different than what they might have been. And so you're enjoying life as well. It's very mixed, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, it is. There's like kind of sorrow mingled with joy in it, because we do recognize, you know, we even recognize that we can't have conversations with our parents at this really high level because our Spanish is not at that level. We do speak Spanish well. We all know how to read and write in Spanish because it was really important to our parents. But there are things like when I talk to my dad that I couldn't have conversations about just because I don't have the vocabulary for it, you know?
Sure. That makes sense too. Okay. Well, one of the things that you do besides talking about the sacraments, you also hang some hooks on a variety of biblical characters. And I thought it might be nice for you to pick one of those biblical character stories and talk about that, and also talk about one of the sacraments that you focus in on. And I thought that might give us a good flavor of how the book works as well. Because
sure.
you're going to learn a lot in The God Who Sees, but you're also going to see pieces of Karen's story, but how it connects to the biblical story as well as the sacramental world, which I love how you've done that. But so mm-hmm. yeah, pick one, maybe a favorite story of yours or whatever. I'll let you go where you want to go with that.
Sure. So one of the characters that I focus on is Hagar. Hagar is someone that growing up in the church, you know, from when the time that I was in the Catholic Church to the time that I joined the Evangelical Church as a college student, you know, I really never heard a sermon about Hagar. I heard lots of sermons about Abraham and Sarah as the sort of the parents of the faith, but Hagar was this kind of interesting story that's part of their journey. It's more like a mistake, like their lack of faith. But that's it. I never really heard anything about Hagar. And then I started digging into, well, why did God want us to know this story? You know, what is it about this story? Here, Abraham and Sarah previously had gone to Egypt, and they'd been mistreated. And Abraham had presented Sarah as his sister, and she'd been taken into the Pharaoh's house. And, you know, he'd been blessed as a result, but she'd suffered, of course, as a result. And so, having been mistreated in Egypt, they turn around and receive this young woman, a young enslaved woman, into their household. And she's going to bear a child for them, they decide. And, you know, Sarah is pretty insistent on this. And then she becomes pregnant. And then the scripture says, depending on what version you're reading, either that Sarah oppressed her or that Hagar disobeyed. But it's interesting, depending on what you're reading.
That's interesting. I've always read mistreated or oppressed.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It just depends on what you're reading, because I've heard different interpretations from people seen it translated differently.
Okay.
But certainly the scripture seems to indicate in the original biblical language that she was mistreated and oppressed. And so she runs away to the desert to seek her own liberation. And so, you know, that might be the end of the story, except that something incredible happens, and that's that God appears to Hagar. I mean, we understand God appearing to Abraham. He's the father of the faith.
Or Mary, the mother of Jesus, you know, the angel, yes. Gabriel. We understand all that.
Yes.
But
God chooses to appear to this foreign enslaved girl who's run away to the desert. And God appears to her in the exact same way that God, through the angel, appears to Mary. Says the same thing. I'm going to bless you. You're going to have a child. Please name this child this, you know, and please return back. You know, he sends her back into Sarah's home. And as if that were not enough, God appears to her again. Years later, Hagar's son Ishmael is born, and now Sarah has her own child, and now she doesn't want Hagar or her child around. And so they run away. They're evicted from the household, and so they run away to the desert, where Hagar assumes her child's going to die. And God appears again through an angel. And this messenger says to Hagar, no, you're going to see your son grow up and he's going to marry from among your own people, you know. And through all of this, you know, Hagar says, you are the God who sees me, because she can't believe it, that God would take note of her, just a slave, a woman, young, foreign, and yet God took notice of her. And so, you know, as I was writing that, I thought about my relatives when they came to the U.S., and many of them doing domestic work, custodial work, having been professionals even in many cases in their own countries, but having to work, and people not seeing them and not noticing them, not knowing that the person on whose labor their vacation is built is maybe an engineer or maybe, you know, or maybe a bookkeeper or a teacher or, you know, any number of things, and that how unseen immigrants are. And in a way, we, you know, people often kind of disregard them, right, as like not the important human beings of society. And in some ways, we dehumanize immigrants. The rhetoric that you hear is dehumanizing, right? Animals, you know, rapists, criminals, even the words like alien are not humanizing words. And so I love that story, because I think it's interesting and important that God put that story for us to read, and that God wants us to know that the only person in the Bible to give God a name is a foreign enslaved girl.
Well, right, Elroy, right?
Yes,
the God who sees. And I guess I would go on to say, you know, correct my theology here if I'm wrong, but, you know, what nation did Hagar really start? What was Ishmael the father of what nation?
Right, and many people say he was the father of the Muslim faith, and he was Egyptian, you know, was Egyptian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's all fascinating as well, right?
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. And the fact that God kept his promise to this foreign young woman, and that, you know, God sees her just as God saw Sarah in mm-hmm. her transgression. God saw Hagar in her vulnerability, and mm. God reached out and appeared to her. And that has to speak to us today as we look around and there are certain people that we deem to be less human. And we may not say that we deem them to be less human, but that is the way we treat them when we say, you're not welcome in our country, you know?
Yeah.
So
I love that you picked that story, and I totally see why it was important to grab a number of biblical stories to talk about in the immigration context. Why the sacraments? And pick mm-hmm. a sacrament and talk about it. And what
sure.
How do they fit in?
Yeah, I think the sacraments are this gift of grace, this gift right from God for us to enter into, right? And I love, so I'll talk about communion, for example,
okay.
which is, you know, one of my favorite chapters in the book. But I talk about how in the Catholic Church, when you decide to do your first communion, it's a process. You have to take classes for a few months, and then there's a formal ceremony with your white dress, and, you know, if you're a little boy in your little suit, And I remember going through that process because I really wanted to know God, and I wanted some peace, Europe, because my country was growing unstable. There was political instability. I could hear my parents talking about people who disappeared. And I always felt drawn to God, and this seemed to be a way to know God through these sacraments, right? And so I pursued it, and I didn't understand what was going on. For some reason, just the language and my age, perhaps I was 9 years old, I didn't understand what was happening. But I knew it was important, and I distinctly chose to pursue it because I wanted to know God, mm. and I thought this was a step in that direction. And so in the book, I talk about Archbishop Romero from El Salvador, who was assassinated while he was in the midst of serving communion. And, you know, this happened around the same time and for the same reasons, around the time my family fled. He had a homily every week where he would read the names of the people who had been murdered or disappeared by the government. He would do this every single week.
Wow.
And this act of remembrance became this huge threat to the Salvadoran government. And, you know, he wanted them to know that these people bore witness and they wouldn't be forgotten.
Yes.
And it cost him his life, you know, in the midst of celebrating communion. He actually was blessing the bread and the cup before serving it to the people. Mm. He was assassinated in church in the middle of the service. And there's a really powerful scene in a film. The film about his life where, you know, the cup falls from his hands. And as you see him fall to the ground, the cup, the wine and the blood are indistinguishable. They look like the same, you know, and it's just pouring out of his chest. And I thought about how often there's a resonance in communion for people who seek liberation. There's a sense of entering into the presence of God, you know, into being with Jesus, who was this Prince of Peace. And it was a very powerful thing for me, even though, you know, I ask in the book, what did it mean to drink a little bit of wine and to have this wafer in the midst of everything happening around me? But specifically what I needed was to be with Jesus, to have Jesus' love be a consolation to me, to have Jesus' peace be with me in this. And that, in fact, even if I didn't know Jesus, Jesus knew me and was with me, because the Bible says that Jesus is present, right, to those who suffer in particular. And so, yeah, so that's one of my favorite chapters in terms of the actual writing, because I felt like it helped me to process a lot of the way that God has been with me throughout my life, and specifically through that season, which was especially turbulent for me as a child. And I think my parents thought, oh, they don't understand. They don't, they're not aware of what's happening. But we were aware. I talk in that chapter about finding a dead body, you know, with my brother and some friends, someone who'd actually been tortured. And so.
And I think I love that particular point about children. They are so much more aware than we give them credit for. they have so much more understanding of spiritual things than we ever seem to allow for as adults. Mm-hmm. You know, spiritual life does not begin as an adult. It begins in the life of the child so often. And so I love that. Well, I think we've given a flavor of the book, along with, you know, your own story interspersed, and a powerful story at that. The book is called The God Who Sees: Immigrants, the Bible, and the Journey to Belong. I hope that we've helped explain some things that I think are confusing about what's currently going on. If you're at all like me, your hearts are breaking at the, you know, what is happening at the border because of the numbers that are coming in, and the slowness of the process to deal with that. And I really do suggest finding a great organization to help that's doing good work at the borders. And again, I have that posted in the show notes, so I hope you'll check those out. Karen, any parting words, any closing thoughts that you'd like to give?
No, I just like people to consider where their views of immigration came from. I find so often when I talk to people that their views are not informed by the Bible. They're informed by the culture, the news, their peer group, their church. But really ask yourself, is the Bible, is it the book that influences the way I think about this issue? Or is it something else? Because as Christians, that should be what shapes our view of immigrants and immigration. So I just encourage people to ask themselves that question honestly in the presence of the Holy Spirit, and to seek that out if they find that, no, it's not.
And I'm going to add to that a quote that I've been hanging on to this week by Anne Lamott: the Holy Spirit rarely respects our comfort zones. I love that quote. So in light of what Karen Gonzalez just said, the Holy Spirit rarely respects our comfort zones. So be ready. Karen, thank you. Thank you so much for writing The God Who Sees. And thanks for sharing and being with us on Faith Conversations.
Thank you so much, Anita. It was great to chat with you.
And to everyone else, I say keep the conversation going.